as on the midterm, if you need to do a calculation, you just need to write out with numbers the equation you would use to evaluate that value. And if you're using a value calculated in a previous part, it's okay to refer to it by its variable name as long as you've already evaluated it. If you're referring to a constant, you should, even if it's on the first page of the midterm at the top, you should state what the value is, just reading it from the first page. If you're using a constant that you don't know the value of and that isn't on the first page, then you probably shouldn't be using that constant. But don't put in random k's where I don't know what the k is. But if you evaluate, say, E in part A, and then you evaluate Q in part B, you're welcome to use E in your expression for Q. I think most people were doing that already on the midterm. So the first three questions of the exam are essentially the same as material covered in for the midterm. First and second laws, definitions. Some of the definitions are from after chapter 4, but same format of question. Typical types of things that show up on that are anything from entropy to stability to optical depth to cape, things like that. The Clausius-Clapeyron equation type question is also similar to the one we had on the midterm where you had to I think it was kind of a swamp cooler type question, except it was before we'd gotten to the swamp cooler type question, so it was a little simpler. Or maybe it was just calculate the saturation pressure at a new temperature. But that's the third question. The fourth question will be one from chapter 4 on 5 or 6 on the Kohler equation, other cloud properties, and or stability. The next question, we'll pull together a couple of things we've been thinking about. We defined the issues with climate models and the representation of clouds. We discussed that a couple times, both on podcast and in person. And we talked about how that affects the sensitivity of a climate model to CO2. And that was important in that it illustrated both some of the complexity of real climate models compared to our Chapter 12 climate model, and it also showed you how uncertain the representation of clouds is in global models and how that leads to uncertainty in the warming. It doesn't lead to anyone thinking that the planet won't warm by adding CO2, but it does illustrate how the feedback effects of clouds are important in determining the temperature. And in chapter 12, we looked at the difference between forcings and feedbacks. And so you also want to think about that in terms of what was in our simple climate model and what wasn't, right? Our simple climate model had no feedbacks. It was just a simple, I'd call it a simplified forcing is in there from CO2, where we said the atmosphere is perfectly absorbing, where actual CO2 wouldn't be perfectly absorbing, but that was our approximation. And then the term project questions I talked about on Wednesday, and I updated in the email just to clarify that since the two projects had focused on either size or concentration, the question will also focus on what the assignment had focused on, even though some of the groups did both. And some of them were more interesting than others, so I was sort of interested in both as well. But just to keep things simple, we'll focus on what was in the assigned term project, which was concentration for rated of transfer and size for precipitation, right? Okay, and that will still be, there'll be four questions. You can pick two of them. You only are graded for answering two. Okay, So here's the whirlwind tour of both. I'll spend a little time on the first four chapters, and then you can go back and review the midterm review for those as well. I haven't included all those slides here because that would take the whole time. And then I'll focus the rest of this time on chapters 5 through 8. So chapter 1 included a lot of basic concepts like what pressure, temperature, and internal energy are conceptually for a fluid, such as air, how we define an ideal gas, and how pressure, temperature, and volume relate for an ideal gas. And this was a relationship that in general we call an equation of state, right, is how pressure, temperature, and volume relate to each other. And of course our favorite equation of state is the equation of state for ideal gas, which is just PV equals RT. We thought about the chemical components of the atmosphere. We focused only on the first 110 kilometers called the homosphere, and those, what are the five main components of the atmosphere? I didn't hear the fourth one.
Nitrogen, oxygen, argon,
CO2, water vapor. Yes. What's special about water? It's very, yes, all of those sounded right. It's variable in the atmosphere. Okay, hydrostatic balance, we all got that one pretty well down, I think. And the consequences for the hydrostatic balance and the ideal gas for thinking about how pressure and temperature vary with Z or altitude, either for a standard atmosphere or an isopycnic or an isothermal or constant lapse rate atmosphere. Who remembers what isopycnic was?
Constant density.
Yep. Okay. So key combined first and second law of results. So first law, dU equals dQ plus dW. dU, and U here I'm reminding you, is exact, mostly because Q and W are not, right? They're path dependent, whereas U is a state variable. And so U is also an exact differential. And so you can substitute in for a reversible process with expansion only. The dQ is dQ reversible, and dW is minus PdV, and we use that expression a fair amount. The definition of enthalpy, entropy, and Gibbs, as before, I always Helmholtz, doesn't end up getting used here, even though it did appear at one point in our discussion. Anyone remember?
It's just the other two variables. So, it's dG minus d few gas d times.
Oh, right. But I mean, why did it show up? And it was because it is actually technically the energy you use to calculate Surface tension. All good guesses, though. But we end up approximating it with Gibbs instead of Helmholtz. So the fact that it's technically defined as 1 is neither here nor there. So entropy. So, and remember here, this is where we got a little funky with the fact that this was a path-dependent variable, or Q is a path-dependent variable. Q reversible is there's only one such path that's reversible. And so that makes it a state variable. So there's only one way to, only one value of heat that can be done, can be gotten in a reversible path. And so we could define a new state variable in terms of these two state variables and then use it because it had this property of essentially representing useful work. Gibbs energy was our third one, and as John was pointing out, they all are defined in terms of each other or can be evaluated in terms of each other. We did a little of that in the problem set where you guys had to calculate U and H and entropy. And so, and all of them are useful in different situations. We focused on Gibbs energy for phase changes because the change in Gibbs energy for a phase change at phase equilibrium is what?
Zero.
And what is phase equilibrium?
It's constant pressure, constant temperature, and constant movement, kilojoule potential.
Yep. Exactly. All three of those. And so under those conditions, dp equals 0, dt equals 0, and dg is equal to 0. And so in this sense, it's useful to think about these. It's really hard to kind of really think physically about what each of these necessarily means. You can think of analogies and situations. Like enthalpy is what we measure as latent heat. So for a temperature change, at constant pressure, but they're really constructs that turn out to be useful, and classically that's how they were developed. And so it was, you know, what equations can we come up with to regulate the use of these different quantities? So chapters 1 through 4 focused on atmospheric composition. We already went over that. First and second laws was chapter 2. Chapter 3, the couple things we really got out of that were the Stefan-Boltzmann equation and Kirchhoff's law. There was also Wien's law. Anyone remember what that told us?
The maximum emitted wavelength was related to inversely related temperature.
I think all those are correct. Where that lambda is a different lambda than we later used for climate sensitivity, I also define as being lambda, because that's what's used. So those, and we thought about things that are useful, but we didn't actually apply that much, direct and diffuse light, and isotropically emitted versus directional light or single direction light. Then chapter 4 was our favorite, water and phase changes, where we were looking at the role of the latent heat of water in determining the dependence of saturation pressure of water with temperature. And we said it was really sensitive because the latent heat was so high, and the latent heat was so high because the intermolecular forces in water are so high. So the difference between a liquid where the waters can kind of touch each other, or at least they're a lot closer, they're technically not so touching, gives you a lot more energy than when they're dispersed in the gas. And so that's the key difference. Chapter 3, like I said, had diffuse versus direct. We mostly focused on looking at irradiance, which is F, as opposed to radiance, I. We evaluated some absorption coefficient and optical thicknesses, but mostly again focused on black body radiation, and that was what led us to these three laws, Planck, Wien, and Stefan-Boltzmann. And actually, Planck's law is really, includes Wien's and Stefan-Boltzmann. If you just integrate over either lambda or t, you get one of these two. One you take the maximum and the other you take the integral. And so Planck's radiation law really includes Wien's law and Stefan-Boltzmann law, and it describes the variation of the irradiance for a black body with both wavelength and temperature. And so that was the big thing from chapter 3, and then we also did chapter 12 kind of with chapter 3, yes?
Is Planck's law integrable for finite limits? Is there or do you have to do discrete integration?
You mean to get Stefan-Boltzmann law?
Yeah, but if you don't want to do it for the full range of wavelengths, you just want it from wavelength A to B.
Okay.
Can you integrate Planck's law?
Yeah.
And you get, it's a different...
You wouldn't end up with Stefan-Boltzmann's law.
No, I understand that, but...
But you would get the value of his... So if we draw a picture, Planck's law would be something would give us some kind of dependence like this, mm-hmm. and your question is, this is lambda. And rather than to get the Stefan-Boltzmann line, take the area under this whole curve,
yeah.
but maybe I have a radiometer that's only measuring from here to here,
mm-hmm.
from 200
but that,
to 400.
But that would be, those are instrument measurements. I mean, is it like an elementary function that you can integrate?
We use Fermi functions.
Okay.
So no, it's not elementary unless
yes.
you just have two functions in here.
Okay. So you approximate it.
Yeah, essentially.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Yeah, I don't see how that relates to anything we've
it's
looked
not,
at then.
I was just curious.
Well then, if anyone wants other things to study for the exam, that's a possibility. The reversible adiabatic work question is one we've looked at a lot, and reversibility is what, and for expansion work, allows us to write our work term in this format where you have a change in volume at constant pressure. Applying the ideal gas law to the first law of thermodynamics and using our equation for internal energy allowed us to get this expression for the change in temperature with pressure for a reversible adiabatic process. And so that's something different, right, from our equation of state. For two reasons. One, we're actually looking at a change from one temperature to another. And the other thing is we actually only have sort of temperature and pressure here, no volume. And so that's the relevant usefulness of this. And you can evaluate it either in terms of internal energy. You can also do the same thing in terms of enthalpy and end up with a relationship that gives you a reversible adiabatic process that looks like this. And so we use this formula not only to calculate how processes would change, but we said it would be really useful to know how temperature changes when pressure changes, assuming a parcel is changing pressure by rising in the atmosphere reversibly and adiabatically, or falling in the atmosphere. And so we end up using this format, to give us this measure of what we call potential temperature, so that we can define a potential temperature to be the temperature a parcel would have if brought reversibly and adiabatically, dry adiabatically, to the surface at a reference pressure of P2 or, which is typically taken to be 1,000 millibars. So, and there was some math involved in getting to this. I'm just going to kind of summarize here. We worked through all this. You can end up with a similar equation using the specific heat at constant pressure for the pressure dependence or specific heat at constant volume for the volume dependence of temperature. And then, as I said, we defined a reference pressure. And that allowed us to define theta as our potential temperature. So you still have to remember what theta is and a few other terms, theta E, theta V, et cetera. So that moves us on to chapter 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. And so, again, to just kind of condense these chapters into a way to think about them, you can summarize in the following way, that chapter 4 is really about will water condense, and that in our atmosphere turns out to depend on whether there are nucleation sites that allow the energy barrier of formation of a liquid associated with forming a surface, because surfaces cost energy, to be surmounted. And so that's chapter 5 I'm already on. Chapter 4 was just will the water condense, which is whether it's supersaturated or not. And supersaturated means that your actual amount of water exceeds your saturation pressure, which is entirely effectively a function of temperature, almost entirely a function of temperature. It's a really strong function of temperature. It doubles every 10 degrees, and Clausius-Clapeyron describes that. And so if you're over this pressure, water will condense. If you're under it, you'll get a little bit of water associated with the aerosols, but we would not form a cloud, so clouds would not form. And so that's, if someone asks you, will water condense, you'd want to specify. You wouldn't form a cloud if you're subsaturated, but you might have a little water in the aerosol, that's fine. And then the question is, where is the water going to condense? What is it going to condense onto? If we were at the surface of the ocean, it would just condense onto the surface of the ocean, but the atmosphere is rather big, and there's a finite transfer rate or motion of water in the air, so it doesn't all immediately go to the surface of the ocean. Instead, it condenses on particles, and what describes whether those particles will take up water is the surface energy limitation, which is described by the Kohler curve, which is the competition between the Kelvin effect and the Raoul effect, where the Raoul effect is the sort of additional energy you get from the water not only condensing, but also solvating a solute, typically a salt. But also that's competing with the energy you need to form a really curved surface. And the more curved, the higher the energy per mass. And so that's the question there. In chapter 6, we looked at, and the answer was the Kohler curve, how much water will condense. And so here we sort of started calculating two things, you know, how much are you above the saturation point? And then once you start condensing water, that generates heat. And once you get hotter, that raises your saturation pressure. And so you may or may not condense all the water over your saturation point. And that's based on this balance between the amount of water condensing and the heat from that. And so the more latent heat you get, the more you warm your air. So, and then in chapter 7, the question was, how does condensed water affect stability? And this is where, among other things, we have this idea of conditional stability, which are times when your air would appear to be stable if it were dry, but if it's wet, it might well be unstable. So I'll come back to that and illustrate that and go back to our definition of stability. And then we start looking at what happens to the water in clouds and how long it takes to precipitate out. So chapter 4, again, was phase equilibria, which we already reviewed. We used the concept of degrees of freedom from our friend the Gibbs phase rule to understand the fact, among other things, that the line of saturation pressures, which is the line between liquid and vapor equilibrium on a water phase diagram, has only one degree of freedom. And that means that if we know the temperature, we know the saturation pressure. And so there's a one-to-one linking there because you know two phases are present at phase equilibrium. Clausius-Clapeyron equations, will the water condense? There's a strong dependence of saturation pressure on temperature. I said all that already. There are two ways to saturate. One is to increase the water vapor, two main ways to saturate. One is increase the water vapor, and the other is decrease the temperature. What's the third way that, like? Mixing of two things, nearly saturated, and then because of the curvature of the saturation line, mixing them linearly ends up making them super saturated. And so the Kohler equation was telling us what will water condense on, and kind of the properties, both the size that they have to be and their composition is the two things that go into this. And so how much the cost is to create this water phase, and then what the energy is from having the solute dissolve. Very simplistically, for an ideal solution, which gave us a pretty simple mixing rule known as the Raoul effect, that was the solution we found. We thought about the concept of nucleation, which for clouds is also called activation. that's mostly used in the cloud literature and not used more generally, because nucleation more generally means formation of any new phase. It, when you put a lot of sugar into water and you crystallize out rock candy, that's also a nucleation process. When you add salt to beer and you make the vapor come out of the liquid phase and form bubbles, that is nucleation of gas in a liquid. So there's very different applications of that. And so, and you want to think of the particles as triggers but not drivers, by which I mean you first need to have chapter 4. You need to know that there's enough water to condense. It has to be supersaturated. And then the particles will be the triggers for getting that water to determining where and onto which particles the water condenses. We talked about some of the interesting history of this development of the polar theory and how it's measured and the implications for the albedo. So there's that was our chapter 5. On chapter 6, we focused, that was sort of now going to the macro scale rather than the micro scale. We included clouds more as larger scale phenomena and as, well, I guess not totally large scale. We were really focused on profiles of temperature and what causes saturation in the atmosphere, and how that relates to this, first a cooling as a way to decrease the saturation pressure. Again, these are our three ways to saturate: cooling, increasing water, or mixing. How much water will condense is determined partly by what you start with, but also how the latent heat interacts with that. The latent heat from condensation causes warming, from evaporation causes cooling. If you're ever in doubt of which causes which, just remember that you're sweating for a reason. And so when you're too hot, evaporation of sweat from your skin contributes to cooling, so that's useful. The dew point and frost point were convenient things that are easily measured that allow us to actually back out the amount of water vapor. And so we looked at those and how they're defined. And they're both defined by cooling isobarically until saturation is reached. And it turns out that relative humidity scales with the dew point depression, which is the difference between the temperature and the dew point temperature. So, and then we thought, again, back to global scale, thinking about the fact that all this heating from water condensing and evaporating is going to affect our energy balance. And it didn't show up in our simple model, and in part that was okay because it actually has to cancel each other out. What you evaporate, you then have to condense. And so that means that what you heat latently, you then have to cool latently because you have to, what goes up must come down, sort of thing. And then we had this way of looking in chapter 7 at the difference between and kind of the life cycle sort of how a parcel that starts out at a different temperature from its environment might cause a cloud and how far it will rise according to that. And so in this illustration here, the parcel you're initially forcing and lifting to get this far up, but when you get to here, that's the point at which the water you have has cooled so much that it's going to condense. The condensation means that rather than following a dry adiabat here, means you're going to follow a wet adiabat, which tends to be steeper up. And that actually puts you above the temperature of the environment. And that difference is what gives you the difference in here is the convective available potential energy, and that essentially determines how much you are accelerating your parcel upwards, how much you can drive it further up before it starts falling again. And so you're still condensing water and condensing water. Then you actually, you know, again have started heating so much that you're no longer super saturated, and so you go back closer to a dry adiabat, and that's where you end up crossing the environment again, and you're no longer warm with respect to the environment. Oh, then I'm going to skip the hydrostatic balance stuff because I already told you guys there won't be a question on it. And because you already know it. That's what I really meant to say. Water saturation pressures, this is just, you know, a favorite iconic diagram for this course, right? Is the water saturation pressure doubling every 10 degrees. And so those numbers you don't have to memorize. Knowing their approximate magnitude may help reduce your confusion if you're doing a calculation so that you're not totally off in the amounts. Our water vapor metrics were all these formulas that we used to convert from mixing ratio to specific humidity to relative humidity, which are partly definition, but you can also do much of the conversion just by using the ideal gas law and thinking about our, you know, sort of magic numbers. 0.622 here is the ratio of the molecular weight of water vapor to dry air. Is 16/29. And then this one here is the complement and the reciprocal of that same number. And so those are handy if that's your easiest way to calculate these values, just to know a couple of those numbers. And of course, the virtual temperature and the virtual potential temperature, while they are temperature metrics, they both depend on specific humidity. So the more water you have, the higher your virtual temperature. Note your virtual temperature is always bigger than your temperature because Q is always positive. If you're looking at your potential temperature, you need the same adiabatic reversible correction to your reference pressure to get to that virtual potential temperature. The definition of relative humidity, it's kind of useful to remember that, right, it's not only the ratio of E, or partial pressure, to saturation pressure, it's also the ratio of W, right, because if it's one, it has to be the other. So you can start with that value either way, right? So if you happen to be given WS and H, you could get WV. I usually end up giving you ES and H, and you can get E and then convert from E to W. You also need W. Or more likely, you probably need Q, because Q is what shows up in these two virtual metrics. And of course, at saturation, relative humidity is really easy because it's just one. Virtual temperature, oh, that was just the reminder. Oh, here were random things that didn't show up anyplace else. Isotropic, same in all directions. Reflection, change in direction but not energy. I think everyone got that last time on a quiz or something. Isentropic, right? Constant entropy. But it actually turns out that constant entropy holds if you're both adiabatic and reversible, right? So that's a cute little implication of first and second law. So that those are equivalent to, say, isentropic and reversible and adiabatic. Chapter 12, we had back in the early part of chapter 12 that we did with chapter 3, the zero and one layer Earth radiation balance model. Used a few assumptions, one of which was ignoring the ocean sink, because we just said incoming equals outgoing, and, you know, a full energy balance would say incoming equals outgoing plus sources minus sinks, and so our sources and sinks were zero. There aren't really any sources that aren't negligible But the sink that is non-negligible is the ocean, but it's small, and so it isn't a bad first approximation to ignore it. We looked at detailed energy streams. This was this iconic Keelan-Trenberg result where there's the atmospheric window and the... I also emphasized the role of latent heat. The atmospheric window is just the part of outgoing infrared emissions, the wavelengths actually, where nothing in the atmosphere absorbs. And so we call it a window because the energy in those wavelengths kind of goes straight through. The major heat-driven features of Earth's circulation that we went over for Chapter 12 were the hydrological cycle, and again, this idea that it controls evaporation and precipitation, and those two end up having to balance. The latitudinal, unless, of course, you had a source or sink of water, but we don't. And so the latitudinal differences in heating, right, you get more incoming energy at the tropics than at the poles, so that ends up driving equator to poleward transport, and you can learn a lot more about both this and zonal heat transfer, all of which is driven by thermodynamics, but thinking about the fluid dynamics and actually making the Earth rotate at the same time is what you get to do in either 217b or GFD or both. So that's about all we said about that. We did, going back to Chapter 7, think about stability. And I started this out by saying, well, if we just had liquid water, right, and little bits of it, and I put hot water on top of cold water, you guys would all know that's stable, because anything where the hot increases as you go up is stable, and anything where it gets colder as you go up is unstable. Right, when I put the cold water on top of the hot water, blue and red became purple. But when I put the hot, the red on top of the blue, it stayed separated. And that's stable because the hot was on top of the cold. So you're not going to induce mixing. The hot is just going to stay hot, and the cold is going to stay cold. And so this would be all we have to think about if we didn't also have pressure changing as we go up. And water vapor changing as well, right? And so I'm thinking back again, the reason, so why does the water vapor change the stability? Why does the amount of water vapor in the air change?
Because it's a different heat capacity.
Yeah, and it is both heat capacity and latent heat from evaporation condensation, and that's, but the condensation is what tends to dominate, and so this is where we actually have water condensing, right, whereas this is where there's more of just looking at the pressure temperature. So the pressure effect gives you sort of way over there, and then if you have water condensing, you have that different condition. And so we sometimes skew the plot, right, so that actual temperature goes this way, but theta E is almost straight up and down. It does have some curvature. And so this gives us a little more room to focus on this interesting part, which is really still on the left side. We've got stable and unstable, and the part in between here, dry and saturated, is
conditionally unstable.
Or equivalently conditionally unstable. And so that's the part where it's stable if it's dry, it's unstable if it's wet. So that's what you have to know. We had different types of clouds, and you guys have now explored a number of these clouds in detail, which is great. The cirrus clouds, and there's two types, but the main category is cirrus. I was calling these the wispy ones. The stratocumulus and stratus are the ones I call wimpy because they're liquid warm clouds near the surface of the Earth. They're low clouds, but they're very thin optically, and they have very little water, so they don't rain as opposed to the cumulus and the super hypercumulonimbus that have lots of water and tend to rain more. So those were the three kinds we focused most on. We didn't talk much about alto stuff, but that's okay. Can't do everything. So this is back to this idea of sensitivity. This was the sensitivity of these models to doubling CO2 sensitivity. And so these are all in terms of Kelvin. So one gives you a 2 Kelvin increase when you double the CO2, and the other gives you a 4 plus Kelvin increase when you double CO2. And the main reason those are different, right, is because this one says, oh, when I double CO2, I end up warming more, so I evaporate more water, and that gives me more low clouds that are highly reflective and cooling. So, and I know here the more clouds is red, which is actually a cooling effect, but all these increases in clouds gives you some cooling that offsets some of the warming of CO2. And so you get only 2 Kelvin of warming. This model says, oh, yes, I do have a warmer planet, but because of that, I'm going to change the profile and the saturation pressure, because at a higher temperature, I have a higher saturation pressure, and so I need more water before I can saturate. So I'm actually going to decrease the amount of clouds. So in addition to just, you know, warming as if, you know, your clouds stay constant, this one actually decreases clouds, and so you get the double whammy. You get decreased clouds and increased greenhouse gases. And we don't actually, there's been some improvements, and the spread is slightly smaller now. But the basic, we still have trouble predicting those things. We thought about cloud types and drop sizes. We focused earlier this week on that, so I won't mention it. The albedo of the Earth is 0.31. It's been amazingly constant to the extent that we can measure it without drift issues. And that gives us an incoming scaled by the ratio of the projected to the emitting area. That's what this 1/4 is, of S0 times 1 minus alpha. So technically, this, the solar constant is the amount of energy per square meter reaching the Earth. This quarter is really only shows up when you balance the FS and the FL, because what you have here as the incoming amount would be pi r squared times S0, and here you'd have 4 pi r squared for the outgoing amount. And so I've actually just grouped those together because it simplifies things later, but you might think about remembering those two so that you know where that quarter comes from. And so if you actually were looking, and I think I mentioned this already, so in the midterm I was actually asking for this amount, and some people gave me this, which I ended up giving credit for because I sort of saw what they were thinking. And then the temperature that we could calculate that way is an equivalent black body temperature, and we can think of that as a mean surface temperature, or, you know, if we're just doing our simple, effectively zero-layer model, then we equate these two and get 255 Kelvin, which is a lot colder than our current temperature. If we add an atmosphere that's perfectly absorbing and in radiative equilibrium with the surface, still with the incoming being transparent, we get a much warmer planet of 303 Kelvin. And so fortunately, our current CO2 isn't perfectly absorbing, and so it's really only 288 Kelvin, but that's the role of the greenhouse gases, the difference between those two results, between the two cold and the too hot is the greenhouse gas effect. And the too cold in the present day is also a greenhouse effect. So in chapter 13, which was on the podcast, there were 3 main feedbacks emphasized, all from the chapter. And these are the important ones to know going forward. The water vapor feedback is strongly positive feedback, nearly doubling the effect of carbon dioxide alone. Relative humidity seems to be approximately constant under climate change. There isn't an intuitive reason for that, but it seems to be true so far. And then relatively dry regions, such as the upper troposphere and polar regions, are especially sensitive. And so what this means, right, is what I just mentioned, how the GFDL model actually ends up with more water vapor because you have warmer temperatures. And so, but water vapor is also a greenhouse gas, right? So having all that water vapor up there means that not only do you have the infrared absorption from the CO2, you also have it from the water vapor. I'll add, I think I said this in the podcast, but I'll point this out anyway. Water vapor is really more of a follower than a driver of climate change because there's so much of it. That sounds a little counterintuitive, but essentially all of the water vapor emissions from combustion and everything else that we do as humans are negligible compared to the amount of water that the hydrological cycle drives. You probably know this intuitively because of how in desert regions water is so expensive, right? Because we don't actually have a way to make water in the amounts that rain provides it. Today was a good example of that, right? It's just much huger amounts. And because the water is going to follow the temperature of the atmosphere. So the increases to the water vapor that we're now seeing aren't driven by the water emitted from combustion. They're driven by the temperature of the atmosphere getting warmer. And then cloud radiative feedback is the other one I just mentioned in the NCAR one, where you actually have changes in the low clouds that give you offsetting cooling. And so that's the second one. Still very uncertain, as illustrated by that difference in sensitivity. And then the snow ice albedo feedback is another big one. This one is also equally straightforward. There's a lot of subtle feedbacks as well, but these are the three key ones that are so big and relatively well understood. But the idea here is almost exactly what the title says, snow albedo feedback. If you melt the sea ice, you change the albedo. So sea ice is white, ocean is dark blue. If you remove sea ice and you go from white to blue, you change the albedo. And that actually tends to enhance warming, right? So the warmer you are, the warmer you're going to get. So that's a large and positive feedback, mostly at northern latitudes, and it's potentially irreversible. Once you do it once, you're not going to be able to undo it, possibly. So these are the same examples that I showed for the midterm. And they'll be posted. And I think that's, and these were just some of the quiz answers. So I think that's all I have. And so we can play Jeopardy now. If any quick questions that you think might be on the test. Or might help you study for the test.
I'm a little confused about the Keelan-Trenberth thing with latent heat of vaporization and how it deals with, like how it mixed into the radiative budget. So clouds condense, like latent heat's released, that adds heat to the system. But then you're saying it has, if you add heat to the system, it has to, whatever's condensed has to evaporate and balance that out. So why do we even care? This is my question.
In our simple model, we certainly don't, and we ignored it for that, and that wasn't an assumption that we worried about. But if you're actually doing a global climate model, it matters a lot for the change in temperature with altitude, because the evaporation happens at the surface and the condensation happens in the clouds. So you're redistributing with the water, you're redistributing heat. So I guess I can be, what's his name?
Alex Trebek.
Unless we have a volunteer who knows all the answers, because you have to know the answers in order to tell people if they're right or not.
No, your team wants you. That's why they said
thank
you.
I'll chapter 3 posted.
Yes, it's just a little offset, so you have to, it's better if you open up the PowerPoint and listen to it rather than watching the slides online. Dan explained that. because, yeah, the timing's offset. I think because I was taping it in live for people who were missing class, and when I do that, it's really, I don't have a way to go back and sync the slides, because PowerPoint claims to record, but it doesn't sync them. So anyway, yes. So, and I don't think, do you think people need to hear the Jeopardy? I don't think they'll get the Jeopardy.